Capital Report is underwritten in part by Hopping Green and Sams, which salutes its client CF Industries for its continuing generous contributions to local communities and charitable organizations in Central Florida each year. I'm Susan Stevens of Hopping Green and Sams Law Firm.
The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire someone with a disability. More information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of abilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, because people want to work. The Fresh from Florida program, supporting Florida's economy by promoting agricultural products grown right here at home, including a variety of seafood harvested by commercial fishermen along Florida's Gulf Coast, on the web at freshfromflorida.com. And Florida Tax Watch, the Florida Council of 100, the Florida Lottery, and AvMed Health Plan, proud sponsors of the Prudential Davis Productivity Awards program, recognizing and rewarding Florida's innovative state employees for their cost-saving ideas since 1989. WFSU-FM Tallahassee, and other Florida public radio stations. From the state capitol, the Florida Public Radio Network brings you Capitol Report.
The U.S. Supreme Court's decision upholding the federal health care law sent shockwaves to Florida leaders who led the charge to overturn it, but others cheered victory.
Well, yesterday was a celebration, and I did my part last night with a glass of Prosecco in my hand before I went to sleep.
Florida is now cleared to remove non-citizens from its voter rolls even this close to an election. That's because of all the exceptions.
You can remove in this 90-day period of time a felon, somebody that's been convicted of a felony, a deceased person, and you can remove somebody that's been court-ordered incompetent.
The plan to privatize about 30 South Florida prisons is running out of time. And in the aftermath of Tropical Storm Debby, we hear what emergency officials are trying to do to get things back to normal. I'm Tramell Gomes, and that's all coming up on Capitol Report. The U.S. Supreme Court has upheld a key part of President Barack Obama's landmark health care law, the requirement that most people carry health insurance or pay a fine, or in the court's words, a tax. In ruling the so-called individual mandate constitutional, the High Court thwarted the efforts of several states, including Florida, to block it. But as Lynn Hatter reports, the outcome of the case has Florida's Republican leaders scrambling to figure out what to do next.
The High Court's decision to uphold the so-called individual mandate caught Florida Republican leaders off guard.
Were we expecting this ruling? No, of course not.
State Attorney General Pam Bondi and Governor Rick Scott were two of several Florida Republicans who won election by riding a wave of opposition against the Obama administration, fueled partly by the passage of the Affordable Care Act. Bondi carried on Florida's fight against the law started by her predecessor Bill McCollum and said all the while that she believed the law would be kicked out. Now, Bondi says the ruling was still a victory for Florida, though not in the way she and other Republican officials were expecting.
We have a choice whether or not to go forward with a Medicaid expansion. We do have to decide what to do, and we have to do it very quickly, working with our governor and our legislature.
Florida now has a choice on whether to cover an additional 1 million Floridians who will become eligible for Medicaid in the next few years. Medicaid is the state and federal partnership for the poor. The federal government told states that they had to comply or risk losing billions of dollars in federal support. But justices said that all-or-nothing approach wasn't fair. And Governor Rick Scott says he's not ready to make that decision just yet.
I'm just absolutely concerned for the citizens of our state. The cost, the ration of care, it's going to have a dramatic impact on jobs. I am very disappointed in what happened.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
The federal government would pick up 90% of the cost to expand Medicaid, but Scott says it's the 10% that falls to the states that he's worried about. The state estimates it would cost about $800 million a year, and other groups say it's around $200 million. Healthcare consumer advocates say they're confident Florida will eventually join the expansion due to the lure of billions of dollars in federal aid coming down to support it. But in the meantime, supporters continue to celebrate the fact that the Supreme Court has deemed the law constitutional.
Well, yesterday was a celebration, and I did my part last night with a glass of Prosecco in my hand before I went to sleep after a very, very busy and a very, very exciting day.
Barbara Devane with the group Florida Alliance for Retired Americans says her celebration started shortly after Thursday's ruling. She says she's looking forward to provisions that protect seniors, such as making sure primary care visits are covered, and the closing of a loophole called the donut hole, which by the year 2020 will mean that many seniors on Medicare will see big savings on their prescriptions. That excitement doesn't extend to everyone, though. Many business groups oppose the law, saying it created an uncertain business climate. The Florida Chamber of Commerce's Mark Wilson says groups are still waiting to see what the law means for them and whether the outcome of the 2012 election will bring about even more changes despite the court's opinion.
So look, we're living in a world of uncertainty. Who knows what's going to happen in the presidential election? Who knows what's going to happen in the U.S. Senate races? This thing could go any number of a dozen different directions.
But I could get two at the same time, right?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
While many business groups may not be happy with the outcome, for small business owner Wendy Halleck of the Tallahassee clothing store Quarter Moon Imports, the possibilities under the new law are endless.
Well, what I'm hoping is that as more people are insured and the rates come down, we may be able to extend our help to be able to help our staff with health insurance needs. So I'm looking forward to that. You know, I've heard some criticisms that this is going to discourage business owners from providing benefits to their staff, but I think it's just the opposite.
Alex says she's looking forward to being able to offer health insurance to her employees. She now has 2 full-time positions and 4 part-time workers, and last year she got a surprise.
I was really excited last year when it turns out, because I'm a small business owner, that the tax credit I got was on my personal income tax, and I had no idea. I mean, I was doing this, but I didn't know that I would get that tax credit, so that was really exciting news.
That tax credit is part of the health care law's incentives for businesses to insure their employees, and several other parts of the law have already gone into effect, like allowing children to stay on their parents' health plans longer. Still, more complex parts of the law, like the health insurance exchanges and the Medicaid expansion, won't be in effect for another few years, and Florida's Republican officials say they aren't in a hurry. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
And it was a lot of sadness and disappointment coming from many who championed the fight against the Obama administration's health care law. We now hear from a man who pretty much started this legal battle in the first place, former Florida Attorney General Bill McCollum. We spoke moments after the ruling was handed down yesterday. Your main contention was this individual mandate. You were saying all along that this was unconstitutional and it couldn't go forward in that way. To see this go in the opposite direction, what do you make of the news?
Well, I'm very disappointed. We didn't expect a ruling based upon the tax law. The government made short shrift. It was sort of a throwaway argument they put into their briefs. But looking at this, just trying to guess at it a bit, the 4 dissenters, Justices Kennedy and Scalia et al., concluded that the individual mandate was not only unconstitutional, but that the entire law had to go down. It wasn't severable. So they would have thrown out the entire law. And it appears that Chief Justice Roberts didn't want to do that. And he was contrived and tried to figure some way. He did a contriving thing with regard to the idea of making this into a tax, and then finding that the tax was not violative of the constitutional provisions that prohibit a direct tax without apportionment. He went through a whole series of rationing, reasoning that don't make sense to me.
Yeah, so Chief Justice John Roberts, to get some context, he wrote the opinion for a 5-4 majority, and he said the required expansion of Medicaid violates states' rights and may be unconstitutional. The states, this is what he said, quote, "The states are given no choice in this case. They must either accept a basic change in the nature of Medicaid or risk losing all Medicaid funding."
Correct, and that was an argument we made, and he bought it, and that became the majority opinion, and that's why we do have a victory in this, even though we didn't get the victory we wanted with the individual mandate. If we're going to change the law now, you have to change the president, and you have to change the majority in the U.S. Senate, and elect a Republican majority of the Senate, keep it in the House, and elect Mitt Romney president. That's going to be the debate for the next few months. Now, regardless of the outcome of the election, I think health care reform is going to be just beginning with this decision. So I suspect that this is going to be a very long and protracted debate that could have been made much more smooth and easier to do if the court had ruled it, thrown it all out, and said start over again.
But as it stands, it's the law of the land, and...
Well, that's exactly right. It's a legislative and congressional, the ball's in their court now. We tested this. Now, there will be other constitutional challenges, by the way, other portions of the law by interested parties that are not necessarily the states. And those are coming along, too, and we shouldn't overlook that fact. But that's separate and apart. We're kind of curious to see how they go. But for the most part, this is a decision for Congress.
Former Attorney General Bill McCollum, thank you so much for taking time to speak with me about this topic.
You're welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. Now let's turn to another battle. This one is over Florida's voter rolls. A U.S. district judge says Florida can remove non-citizen voters from its rolls even though it's less than 90 days before the August 14th primary. But he warns officials to be careful about how they identify ineligible voters. And Regan McCarthy reports, some say there's no guaranteed way to make sure only illegally registered voters are targeted.
Following the judge's decision, the association that oversees Florida's election supervisors is telling members they can go ahead with removing ineligible voters from their rolls, but need to be certain they're only targeting voters who aren't legally allowed to vote. Ron Lebaski is the general counsel for the association.
All the supervisors throughout the state have always operated with that as the initial predicate of making sure that you have very, very strong documentation and proof that would indicate clearly that the person is not properly registered before removing somebody. Obviously, that can be a variety of factors in the various localities around the state.
Lebaski says the decision about whether to move forward with the purge is up to individual election supervisors. In Leon County, election supervisor Ion Sancho says he doesn't plan to remove voters, saying he's not convinced even an updated list based off federal immigration data would be accurate enough.
One of the things that has not been accurately examined is how accurate the federal database is. And my own analysis of the federal database is that it is not accurate itself, and that the state is sort of hanging its hat on something that actually doesn't exist.
The move comes after the U.S. Department of Justice asked Wednesday for a temporary restraining order to stop Florida's efforts to purge ineligible voters from its rolls. Lawyers for the department argue the purge violates a federal law that prohibits the removal of voters from the rolls within 90 days of an election. But Florida's elections head, Secretary of State Ken Detzner, says exceptions are made in certain cases, and he thinks non-citizens count.
You can remove in this 90-day period of time a felon, somebody has been convicted of a felony, a deceased person, and you can remove somebody that's been court-ordered incompetent. So those three categories of people, those people at some point in time in their lives may have been eligible to vote, but because of circumstance with the court or being deceased, they can be removed.
And the judge who heard the case, Judge Robert Hinkle, agrees with Detzner. Hinkle says a person who's not legally allowed to vote, like a non-citizen, can be removed from the rolls within the 90-day period. But he says the state needs to be careful about how it targets non-citizens. He says the state's list, which is built from driver's license information, has too much room for errors. That's an issue Ben Hovland with the Fair Elections Legal Network says his group, which is involved in another lawsuit against the purge, is raising concerns about.
People ended up on this list because of the last time they visited the Florida Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles. From that information, we can tell from the list that some of these people's last visit was in the 1980s or 90s. Years have passed since people last went into the DMV, and in that time, many of these individuals have become naturalized. Additionally, as we've seen in the media, there have been people who have ended up on this list who were U.S.-born citizens.
Florida officials say they recognize there are problems with the list they made using driver's license information. That's why they say they've stopped their efforts to remove voters until they can get a more accurate list based off the information from a federal immigration database. Michael Carvin is a lawyer representing the state.
They're not pursuing the old database, but they're trying to get the accurate database from the federal government, and presumably the federal government will give it to them soon.
Meanwhile, Governor Rick Scott is calling the judge's ruling a victory. Scott says in a statement he's pleased with the outcome, and Scott's communications director, Brian Burgess, says the state is continuing its efforts to ensure the integrity of Florida's election.
We need access to the SAVE database. We've made that very clear. The federal government knows that we have the data fields that they need for us to access the database to find non-citizens, and that's all we're asking for, and that's what we need to move forward.
State officials are suing the federal government for access to that database and say they'll publish a new list of ineligible voters once they get it. The state is facing two more lawsuits from voter and civil rights groups. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Still to come on Capitol Report, a plan to privatize South Florida prisons gets a hearing in an appeals court this week, with opponents arguing the plan is an overreach of legislative power.
How in the world will the governor exercise his veto power? He would have to veto the entire DOC operating budget. It doesn't make any sense.
Emergency management crews still can't travel safely in many areas to assess all the damage left behind from Tropical Storm Debbie.
And we're not done by any stretch. We haven't done all that much in the flooded areas of Stop Chop because we can't get in and see a lot of the stuff at this point.
And we'll head to South Florida, where opponents are fighting against a proposed wind farm near the Everglades.
And I think the people who live out there are ultimately going to regret the decision to put them out there. Also, there are problems from lighting and how that will impact migratory birds as well.
A gross misuse of power. That's how a plan to privatize about 30 South Florida prisons was described at a Tallahassee appeals court hearing this week. And as Ronald J. Eben reports, because of a deadline coming up tomorrow, the prison plan will likely die before the legal challenge against it gets resolved.
On Wednesday, lawyers debated whether the Florida legislature had overstepped the bounds of its power when it approved the controversial privatization plan. Attorney Stephen Turner, arguing on behalf of the Florida Department of Corrections, said because the legislature folded the plan into the department's overall budget, rather than making it a separate bill, Florida Governor Rick Scott was left with little choice but to sign off on the plan.
How in the world will the governor exercise his veto power? He would have to veto the entire DOC operating budget. It doesn't make any sense.
If the legal challenge hadn't stopped the plan, it would have outsourced operations in all 29 of South Florida's prisons, from Vero Beach down to the Florida Keys, to private companies. An appropriations committee had added the plan to the Department of Corrections general budget late in this year's legislative session. But a circuit judge then ruled the plan unconstitutional because she said it was an overreach of the legislature's power. And on Wednesday, at the appeal hearing, Justice Dickie Ann Clark raised the same question. She asked Assistant State Attorney General Jonathan Gokow whether the multi-prison plan was too far-reaching according to budget rules.
In its legislative budget request...
For a prison, not 29.
No, it doesn't say a prison. It just says for prison...
A facility.
Well, I don't think it says...
Go on, finish
up. Okay, anyway...
But after the hearing, Glogau said lawmakers had been completely within their rights.
As Mr. Turner said, there are constitutional limitations on what they can do. Our argument is that they met those limitations.
The deadline to privatize the prisons is tomorrow, and Glogau conceded no action could likely be taken before then, regardless of how the judges rule. But the justices suggested their ruling might help inform future legislative decisions, even if it doesn't have any effect in this case. That means lawmakers who push for prison privatization would have to try again during the next legislative session. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ronald J. Eben.
You're listening to Capitol Report on the Florida Public Radio Network. I'm Tremel Gomes. Tropical Storm Debbie caused floods, destroyed homes, and took the lives of seven Floridians this week, leaving a mark on most of the state. As Jessica Palumbo reports, even though Debbie has made her exit from Florida, officials are just beginning to assess the damage she left behind and figure out how to recover.
Debbie smacked into Florida early on Sunday after marinating in the Gulf of Mexico for a day. In the early morning, she spawned tornadoes that left a South Florida mother dead. A steady rain continued falling in the Big Bend through Monday and Tuesday, forcing thousands of people in coastal and low-lying areas to evacuate their homes. One of the evacuees was 19-year-old Kelly McLaughlin, whose home in the town of St. Mark's is in one of the hardest-hit areas, Wakulla County.
I've seen cars parked on higher ground. I know two of our neighbors are gone. I don't know where they went. Me and my mom are leaving. My neighbor down the street, he's already gone.
On Monday, McLaughlin was working at a Subway restaurant and said she worried about how to get past police blockades to rescue her two dogs and a cat from her home. In another Wakulla County town called Panacea, Susan Pafford waits tables at Coastal Restaurant. And when she finished her shift on Monday night, she saw that the road back to her home had disappeared underneath a massive current of rushing water. She didn't let that stop her from going home, though.
Yes, ma'am. So we go really, really slow and keep going. Yeah, keep going right through the middle of it. I drive a Ford F-150 pickup truck, thank goodness. But I was thinking about all the folks that might be in cars that might not make it across there.
Pafford said her yard was soaked when she got home, but it looked like her house would be okay. Many across the state haven't been so lucky. In Wakulla County alone, Debbie damaged 387 homes, destroying 45 of them completely. And Keith Blackmar of the Wakulla County Sheriff's Office says overall damage there totals $8 million. But estimates will most likely grow as waters recede.
And we're not done by any stretch, and we haven't done all that much in the flooded areas of Sopchak because we can't get in and see a lot of the stuff at this point.
Starting Saturday, state and federal emergency management officials will begin their damage assessments to determine the possible need for FEMA dollars. State emergency spokeswoman Jessica Sims says she has received reports of con artists posing as investigators to try and take advantage of storm victims. She offers these tips to protect against the fake agents.
Preliminary damage assessment team members may ask about your damages and insurance, but do not require any personal identifiable information, such as your social security number.
She also says state agents will always carry state identification. The areas they'll be investigating first are those with active flooding, including Wakulla, Pasco, and Dixie counties. And with feet of rain saturating soil across the state, costly and potentially dangerous sinkholes are plaguing many counties. Rebecca Halmuth, a University of Florida student, was collecting soil samples at a Suwannee County peanut farm on Wednesday when she came across a hole that was bigger than a truck.
It was about 5 feet from the road and about 30 feet across, I think, and 15 feet deep.
Debbie ultimately killed 7 Floridians and leaves communities across North Florida flooded. And State Emergency Management Director Brian Kuhn says his agency will continue monitoring the situation for a long time to come.
The smaller rivers are going to be cresting over the next couple of days. Those are going to flow into the larger river. So we're going to have some flooding, river flooding issues for the next week or two.
And it's not just government agencies who have been pitching in with the storm recovery effort. Jamie O'Rourke of Volunteer Florida says about 200 volunteers have already worked 1,600 hours to help storm victims.
They've been giving out meals, they've been setting up shelters, been helping with distributing cleanup kits, all sorts of activities.
She says for those who want to help, the most immediate relief comes from cash donations to well-established relief organizations like the American Red Cross. And it turns out Debbie did some helping of her own. In addition to all of the devastation she's left behind, with more than 2 feet of rain in many regions, Debbie has cured Florida of a long drought that affected the entire state just 2 months ago. Now, the percentage of Florida that's experiencing drought is less than 0.5%. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
Finally, the winds of change are coming to Florida, so to speak. This could be good news for a proposed wind farm in Florida, which has yet to have one single windmill in this state known for its powerful winds. But opponents are saying that the 100-plus turbines near the Everglades area will be a mechanical eyesore that will lower property values. Reporter Patricia Sagastume traveled to the Glades area and tells us the answer is more than just in the eye of the beholder.
There are no wind farms in Florida, at least not yet. Now there's a proposal to build the first one near the Tri-City community surrounding Lake Okeechobee. The gigantic windmills would stand nearly as tall as the Washington Monument. The blades, nearly half the length of a football field, would stretch across more than 10,000 acres of farmland. In a state where tourism is king, will this wind farm become an eyesore or eye candy on the horizon? Kendra Snow, a real estate agent in Belglade, says it boils down to one issue.
Anything that will bring a job to the Glades, we are interested in.
Drew Martin from the Loxahatchee chapter of the Sierra Club says they're not against wind energy. They just don't like corporate wind farms in general because they're ugly and harm wildlife.
And I think the people who live out there are ultimately going to regret the decision to put them out there. Also, there are problems from lighting and how that will impact migratory birds as well.
At a local diner, I sip tea with Mayor J.P. Sasser, who was born and raised a stone's throw away in neighboring Pahokee. He's not thrilled when outsiders like the Sierra Club tell him what his town needs.
I've got citizens that need jobs and clothes on their back and health insurance and everything else, so birds don't make my top 10 list.
Sasser believes the giant rotation of the blades across the skyline will inspire tourism.
Here in the Glades, the land is perfectly flat, so all of them will be on the same level, and they will be able to do somewhat of a geometric pattern. I'm looking for it to bring tourists.
It's not a far-fetched idea. Peter Kelly, Vice President of Public Affairs for the American Wind Energy Association, says across the country, people pay for a view or a tour of a wind farm.
Interestingly enough, Atlantic City, New Jersey, hired a pollster to ask tourists, would they like to see these turbines? And they said, yes, make them closer so we can see them. And already the five turbines in Atlantic City are the source of requests for hotel rooms on the side that faces the turbines.
Tourism in the Glades would be a godsend. This area, which is world famous for its sweet corn and sugarcane, is also known for its historic poverty.
This is an American story that begins in Florida.
It was a feature locale for Edward R. Murrow's Harvest of Shame documentary in the 1960s. These days, unemployment hovers just below half the population. More and more farm labor is being replaced by machines. Sugarland Wind Farm officials say there will be hundreds of temporary jobs, but about a dozen when the farm is up and running. Eric Hopkins, along with several other farmers, leased large portions of their farmland. Before he made up his mind, he went to Missouri to see a wind farm for himself.
He was quite impressed that the wind farm was nice. It fit into the farming community, and they're not an ugly thing. They're actually sort of pretty. Don't stop.
At the Glades Day School, students sing and hope there'll be a job for them when they come back from college. Whether this wind farm breaks ground depends on money and more federal approval. Congress also needs to renew a wind tax credit that expires by the end of the year. Without it, analysts say most wind farms will fail or have to scale back. But that won't happen to the Sugarland Project, says its director, Robin Size.
Those other wind farms you read about are in markets where there's a lot of wind and saturated. By this being the first wind farm here, we have a little bit of a first mover advantage.
I'm Patricia Sagas-Stumann in Belglade.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Tom Flanagan, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo. Thanks also to the contributing stations along the Florida Public Radio Network. Taylor Cox provides technical assistance for Capitol Report, and I'm Tramell Gomes, inviting you to join us next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org.
Capitol Report is underwritten in part by Hopping Green and Sams, which salutes its client CF Industries for its continuing generous contributions to local communities and charitable organizations in Central Florida each year. I'm Susan Stevens of Hopping Green and Sams Law Firm.
The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust, because people want to work. The Fresh from Florida program, supporting Florida's economy by promoting agricultural products grown right here at home, including a variety of seafood harvested by commercial fishermen along Florida's Gulf Coast, on the web at freshfromflorida.com. And Florida Tax Watch, the Florida Council of 100, the Florida Lottery, and AvMed Health Plan, proud sponsors of the Prudential Davis Productivity Awards program, recognizing and rewarding Florida's innovative state employees for their cost-saving ideas since 1989. WFSU-FM Tallahassee, and other Florida public radio stations. This is the Florida Public Radio Network.